tempted to abort. Despair and fear can lead to the violence of abortion unless we intervene and show that the Lord is walking with us. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
This is full-time Catholic radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
D.L. Hudson. Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I have a very special guest today, William Peter Blatty, who I will call Bill because he's a friend, is well known throughout the country, if not the world, for his book and then movie, The Exorcist, which made his name and the whole phenomenon of exorcism something that this country has never stopped talking about. But he's here today to discuss with me his most recent book, which came out from Regnery just a month or so ago, entitled Finding Peter, A True Story of the Hand of Providence and Evidence of Life After Death. Bill, thanks for coming on Church and Culture today.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thank you for having me, Dale.
Bill, I want to read you the first line of the review that I'm going to publish tonight. At the Christian Review website, and it's this. Honesty is rare, and when it's found in a book such as this, the effect is quite arresting and compelling. It's difficult to be honest in print. Do you think that's true? I mean, I find it difficult to be fully honest.
I do. I find it difficult to be in print still. Actually. I was a comic novelist in my real life, and after The Exorcist, everything changed, of course. But writing funny was like almost like breathing for me, but straight prose like The Exorcist, it was almost like mental manual labor. However, this book, Finding Peter, is quite different. It's actually, in a way, a reversion back to my early writing style.
Yeah, it is quite humorous in places. It begins with the story of your youth in New York City, growing up very much poor, but with an unbelievable mother, who we're going to talk about in a minute. It was jaw-dropping at times to read some of the stories about Mary, your mother, and your life growing up there in Lower East Side and then in Queens, I believe, in Brooklyn, too.
Well, also in Brooklyn. We did probably, over 20 different addresses, which I guess made us the only nomadic tribe living in Brooklyn at the time, seeing as much.
That's why when you went for a job with the FBI, they said they couldn't do a background check.
No, they couldn't. I lived there too many.
It would take too long.
That's what kept me from entering the ranks of the CIA.
Well, you know, your book's all about providence, isn't it?
It is absolutely about providence.
It's about providence and the reality of the other life, but it's not another life in the sense that it's somewhere separate. It's intertwined with our own.
It is absolutely. It's right next door to us.
So you have a book here that's quite unique and quite compelling, and I'm going to be urging everyone to read it.
Not
just because you're my friend and because I believe in what you say, but because it's the kind of book that is rarely written, because you address the very, very tragic death of your son, Peter. And that's why it's called Finding Peter.
Right.
And you write this book, you say several places, to be helpful to those who have suffered the loss of a child.
Absolutely. And to that end, Gil, all the proceeds of the book, and I've mentioned it in the book, in fact, are going to Peter's high school, The Heights, here in Potomac, Maryland. And I did that to further build the trust of the reader that I haven't made any of this material up. It's all true. It all happened.
Well, I might say that that begins with the story of your mother.
Oh, yeah.
Because she seems like almost a fictional character as well.
Oh, larger than life.
So that story about I'm going to meet FDR really happened, huh?
It actually happened. We were living right beside in Manhattan on 31st Street, I believe it was, the Queens Midtown Tunnel site. And the day of the great opening came, and there was Franklin Delano Roosevelt in an open-top convertible to cut the ribbon on the tunnel. And my mother was determined to meet him. And she took me by the hand, and in the other hand, she had a shopping bag, I remember. And she boldly approached the car. I guess the Secret Service made a dive for her, but they didn't lay a glove on her. And before she had extracted a jar of homemade quince jelly from the bag, and she handed it to the astonished president and said, "For you, quince jelly, for when you have company."
But then he had to sort of push the Secret Service away. They were going to jump her.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he smiled. He smiled, and he accepted the jar from her. Yeah.
But the scene that really sort of got me in the gut a little bit, and by the way, I've read quite a few biographies of Hollywood actors, actresses, directors, and I'm sure you know that many of them start out just the way yours did. Poor in New York City, one parent, hungry, you know, scraping along,
yeah,
moving from address to address. I mean, Clara Bow has the absolute worst story of a childhood I've ever read.
Oh, really?
Anybody. But there you were with your mother, Mary, and you were on the steps of the great and prestigious Plaza Hotel.
Oh.
In New York City, and you're hawking quince jelly, and you're telling your mother that this is just like begging, Mom. And she says, "It's not begging in Lebanon."
Yeah. It's an honorable profession. She also added, you forgot to, she said, "You shut up."
Right, exactly. And so she... I must say, she's one of the most remarkable characters I've read in a book in a long time. And,
yes, she was. She was amazing, an amazing woman. She raised five children that my dad left us when I was 3 years of age, and she did it all on her own, peddling homemade quince jelly in the streets of New York. The woman was a dynamo, and the heart of the energy that made her work was her faith in God, and her faith that ultimately, you know, everything is going to turn out well, everything is going to be okay. That was that brings to mind when she invited a lady friend for a Thanksgiving afternoon dinner, and the lady friend brought a date. It was like 60, 70 years ago. I'll never forget the man's name. His name was and I've just Neil Sullivan. I almost forgot it.
Neil Sullivan, but, and that led to Georgetown.
He, because he was a layman, a teacher of theology at Georgetown. And because he had over two helpings, the moment they left, my mother closed the door on him. She whirled around to me and stuck her arm out and pointed and said, "You're going to go Georgetown." And I said, "Mama, that's a rich kid school. I'm not going to." "Hey, you shut up. You're going to win scholarship." Well, who knew? Just to keep Dear Mama from Nagging Me, which was her forte. I trudged up to Columbia University, took the 7-hour college entrance exam on the basis of which whoever did the best got a scholarship to Georgetown, and was certain that I had done so poorly that had my father been Rockefeller, Georgetown wasn't. This is not false modesty either. I believe I did very poorly. And yet, while I was working as a waiter in the Catskills, I get a letter from Georgetown. I won the scholarship. And I call my mom excitedly, Mom, I won the scholarship. I know. That was her total reaction. And she didn't know how. God alone knows.
Extraordinary. After every segment of the book, chapters or stories, you tell the reader, you know, I'm showing you how Providence has worked in my life and has worked in sometimes, spooky ways in that, you know, what if Dick Cavett, two guests, hadn't have had problems? Your book, you had just published The Exorcist and nobody was buying it. It was dying. And you happened to be in New York, happened to be near the studio. You had already been rejected for an appearance on Dick Cavett.
That's right.
Then you get a last-minute call. They've had a cancellation. You go over there, and you've got the amazing British actor Robert Shaw in front of you, who always, you know, talks lengthy stories.
Yeah.
But he's drunk.
Yeah.
And so they pull him off, and all of a sudden you've got most of the show to yourself.
Well, yeah, normally the actor, the author back then got the author spot. I don't care if you were the ghost of William Shakespeare. You got 5 minutes at the end of any network show. And in this case, both Keith Purcell and then Robert Shaw had to get the hook after one segment apiece, and there was no place for them to go. And I came out on stage, and Dick Cavett did that little shake of his body he does in the chair and said, "Well, Mr. Blatty, I haven't read your book. And, oh, shall I tell you about it? Oh, for God's sake, please." And I got to do a 41-minute monologue about my novel, interrupted only by one question and two or three commercials. And from being, you know, returned by the train load within, I think it was 3 weeks because of Cavett, it was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Now, that's all part of that chain of providence. I mean, I think back and I say, what if I'd been in the restroom when the telephone call came from the studio? And what if I'd been in a cab? Wouldn't I have, you know, all those things go through my mind. But, you know, it slowly built. Even before that, I'll just give you one little link in the chain of providential causality here. I was invited to a New Year's party by a fellow screenwriter and novelist, Burton Wool. I said, "Burton, I'm sorry, I don't go to, haven't gone to a New Year's party in over 10 years. And it's, you know, someone at stroke of midnight always does something horrifically embarrassing, if not revolting. And that person is usually me." So I think, you know, he said, "Oh, Bill, come on. It's only going to be 7 or 8 people. And leave at 10:30 if you want." And because I liked him so much, you know, I relented. And I showed up, and there was a man with a mustache sitting on a hassock facing me. And he seemed to know me. He seemed to know of my comic novels. And he said, "Hi, Bill, what are you working on?" Well, it turned out he was Mark Chaffee, editor-in-chief of Bantam Books.
Wow.
And for a moment, I considered telling him about my idea for a book about demonic possession, and did I dare risk my reputation as a comic novelist with him by doing it. Well, I'd had enough to drink to do it. And I don't recall talking for more than a minute and a half, because that's all I knew about the book. It was about demonic possession, and I knew the symptoms, period. And he said, "I'll publish that."
Whoa.
And he did, yeah.
You know, I'm looking here at the summit, sort of summary list of what ifs that you have in your book, one of those being the story you just told.
Yeah.
But every one of them is could have very easily not happened.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, just a shrug of the shoulder, you're saying, I really can't go to your party.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Deal, I don't know if I don't recall whether or not I mentioned this in your book, but, oh, God. Now I'm losing it. It was a point of such an incredible providence, as a matter of fact. Well,
you have the seven. You know, you have the points about the Cabot Show.
Yeah.
The Neil Sullivan. The
that was a huge one. The Neil Sullivan, because
that got you out of the ghetto.
That got me out of the ghetto, and boy, the ghetto was not a happy place in those days. We rarely, you know, of course, we couldn't pay the rent usually. Back then, you didn't pay first and last deal. You paid first month. And my mother, you know, would greet, repel all requests for rent after that. Those days, the landlord came right to the door and stuck his or her hand out saying, give me the rent. And she would just slowly close the door on them. With an accusatory look and say, I know all about you.
I love it.
Rugged landlord. Boom. Then she'd buy us two or three, maybe 3 months there before we got evicted. And that was a bitter, cruel thing back then.
And you would come home and find all your stuff out on
the sidewalk. Yeah, the marshals would come in and they'd clean out everything, your furnishings, personal possessions, and dump them on the sidewalk.
You'd be humiliated.
Time in the pouring rain.
You know, I want to remind our readers, I'm talking to William Peter Blatty, the well-known author of The Exorcist, about his latest book, Finding Peter, A True Story of the Hand of Providence and Evidence. Evidence for what, Bill?
Life after death. Absolutely.
Life after death. And he and his wife, Julie, were visited by the horrible moment when his wife went down to early in the morning feeling like something was wrong, perhaps with their son Peter, and found him dead in front of the television set of a extremely rare visitation of where the immune system turns on the heart. Now, can you elaborate on that for us, Bill?
Viral myocarditis. Yeah, Petey had a heroin problem recently acquired because he broke up with his girlfriend. She dumped him on Christmas Eve, and he found someone who gave him a shot of heroin. So he'd been with his mother to the methadone clinic that morning, and that is the only reason he apparently felt not a bit of pain when he passed away. Julie found him, the TV remote in his hand, his head aimed at the TV screen, and a pleasant expression on his face. And he was just his time to go. He was a beautiful human being. He was bipolar. And I like to think that he was such a beautiful person that God decided to take him early and spare him all the horrors of living with bipolar 1, which is what he had.
Well, you tell some stories about his very early childhood that are just absolutely remarkable. He seemed to be a young child kind of drunk with God from the very beginning.
I think so. Yet I could sum it up with a couple of quotations from Pete at the age of 3. In the first instance, we were living in Santa Barbara, and his mother was dressing Paul, his younger brother, and Pete was standing at a window just staring out at the landscape when he said, Mommy, do you know why I came here? By the way, notice the phraseology, came here?
Mm-hmm.
And Julie said, No, sweetheart, why? He said, I came here to help people. Another time.
How old was he?
Yeah, three.
Wow.
Another time at the same age, and he confronted both Julie and I with this. He said, how do you learn? And I said, oh, books and experience.
That's the one that got to me.
Yeah, he said, that's not how I learned that. Oh, really? How do you learn? I learned from the sky. God teaches me. And he was also capable. There's nothing paranormal connected with this, but at the age of five, he said something only the most gorgeous soul could come up with to his mother. He said, Mommy, you know, when God was making me, I was a little bit scared and a little bit sad, but then I saw you.
Whoa. Wow. I mean, that is so beautiful.
Yeah, he also, he was packing a little lunchbox once with pretend things, and Julia's mom said, oh, sweetie, what do you do? Oh, I'm making a trip. Oh, really? Where are you going? I'm going to a star. I'm a little star boy. Well, I've come to believe maybe in a way there was some literal truth behind that.
You then talk about the events that begin to happen. I believe was it the evening of the death or the morning after? I think the morning after he died.
It was the morning after. I don't precisely remember, but in the first few days after Peter's death, I know that I had received some gentle little signs that maybe were messages from him. And so one day that month of his passing, November, I was standing out on the back deck looking out at a forested area behind the house. And I looked down at a tree that had been planted there in memory of Pete by one of his high school classmates. And I said, it was now November, and I said aloud, okay, Petey, here's a sign. I want that tree to blossom and bloom on my birthday. Well, we're in Maryland. My birthday is January 7th. And on the morning of January 7th, I bounced out of bed, slurped down some black coffee, and ran down to that tree. And deal, there were green shoots.
You went down there expecting to see them.
Well, hoping to God to see them. And there were green shoots. Of course, I would love to say...
In January.
On January 7th, I would love to say they blossomed, the flowers. They didn't. The tree died, I think, that day. It died. Which ties in with another Peter phenomenon, which concerns a halogen light. Julie and I are watching British Homicide TV series one night, featuring in this scene a detective whose wife has died and who had her buried in his backyard. And every night he gets drunk and he sits on a bench and he talks to his wife. And on this night, he said, word for word, Sarah, why don't you ever give me a sign? Why don't you turn on a light or something? Well, reflexively, I immediately turned and looked up at a photo of Pete on the mantle because I thought I'd been getting some messages from him. And then I looked up at this four-globe chandelier over the TV area. It was off. And then I lowered my head and shook it, of course. It was ridiculous. It wasn't going to turn on a light. Within 15 seconds maximum, too. Julie and I turned to look at one another because a light source had appeared in the room. It was a halogen lamp on top of one of my filing cabinets. I'm looking at the filing cabinet right now. And it was on. It had turned itself on. The light didn't flicker. It was a steady burn. And, you know, 10, 15 seconds, and then it went off. Of course, we jumped up to examine it, and the lamp was dead. It never worked again.
So now, you've had a whole basket full of experiences like this. And also friends of yours and friends of Peter have had experiences.
yes.
of Peter from the afterlife.
Death. Well, that's how I interpret it. For example, there was an elementary school teacher, a woman, I won't name her, but she was very fond of Peter, and Peter was fond of her. And she tells us that she was in bed with a cold on Easter Saturday. When was this? I don't know, maybe 6 years ago. And she got up to get a box of Kleenex from her husband's side of the bed, and she got into bed. And she turned, and she said aloud, "Peter, I want you to give me a sign. I want you to give me a peep." Now, it was Easter Saturday. And shortly, moments after saying that, I said, "Oh, my God, why did I say that? Nobody in this house is going to bring a peep. Everybody here hates peeps. Oh, God, I asked for the wrong thing." Well, some time went by. The TV hadn't been working. Her husband, Greg, arrived home, and he fixed the TV so it was not working. And she went over, got more Kleenex, got into bed, turned on the TV. First, she thought she saw, he was a black preacher, I've forgotten his name. And then that image yielded to one of a TV anchorette. And she was extending her hand, holding a peep in it.
Wow.
To the viewer and saying, "And here's a peep for you."
Oh, my Lord. Bill Blatty, we're going to take a quick break and come right back to this and other stories from your recent book, Finding Peter.
Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews. When I interview the people who are engaged in remarkable ministries that are making a real difference in their parishes and the world. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Hi, this is Father John Ricardo, inviting you to join me as we explore some of the deepest questions that arise in our hearts. Questions that shape the way we think, the way we speak, and the way we live. For all of these questions, Christ is the answer.
Our individual and corporate relationship with our Lord. Our relationship with the church, the precepts of the church. Our relationship with the world and the culture that surrounds us. Father John Ricardo discusses these things and more, all from the Catholic perspective, on Christ is the Answer. Listen to Christ is the Answer Wednesday evenings at 8, Saturday afternoons at 5, and Sunday mornings at 11 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. He is the image of the invisible God. He points us to our destiny. He reveals the dignity of the human person. He is the one who makes known the Father. Christ is the Answer.
Christ is the Answer is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Ever thought you'd make a bundle by trading in or selling your used vehicle only to find out it's worth a dinner for two? Well, it's much more valuable to donate your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Thousands of Americans donate their vehicle each year. The donation to Ave Maria is easy, tax-deductible, and supports our efforts to evangelize. A year from now, will you remember that dinner or your gracious and selfless donation? Go to AveMariaRadio.net to find out more. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm back with William Peter Blatty, whose new book, Finding Peter, is magnificent. I read it in one sitting, and strongly recommend that our listeners read it. All the proceeds are going to be going to the high school in Potomac, Maryland, that Peter Blatty, the son, late son of the Blattys, attended. Bill, in your book, you tell a very moving story, again, more evidence for life after death, about your son's miraculous medal.
Oh, well, yes. That was actually the second big sort of message or sign that I had noticed after his passing. I wore Peter. I got a chain and I started wearing Peter's medal around my neck. And one day I awakened and the chain was around my neck, but the medal was gone. Well, I want to tell you, Julie and I spent, I don't know how much time, searching the area of the bed, under the bed, and in particular in my shower. Now, my shower is only 4 by 3.5, something like that. It's a very small area. Each of us searched it repeatedly. One day, I was to give a talk down.
Which you don't like to give.
Oh, I despise public speaking. I really do. I'm always, I get a knot in my stomach. I'll come back. If you remind me, I'll tell you why that is. But as I showered, I remember saying aloud, Pete is going to find that medal for me. And on the day I was to give the speech, I was once again in the shower. And I happened to look down, and there was something glinting, shining on the shower floor. And I reached down, and it was the medal. Now, as I said, Julie and I had searched it repeatedly for the medal. And Julie,
because it was your son's medal.
It was precious
to you.
Indeed. Julie in particular has an eagle eye. Now, we're only talking about a very small square foot area to search. And one day, during all our multiple searches, I placed a penny, which was almost the identical color of the tile on the floor of the shower. And I brought Julie and I said, Julie, is there anything here in the shower? And she took a quick look and said, no, there's just that penny over there. That's how acute her eyesight is. And yet she searched that shower with me endless times. Never saw anything. That medal just appeared. It just appeared.
And again, you know, you prepare the reader for these stories by talking about your background growing up very poor in New York, about your success in Hollywood, about your years working for the United States Information Agency in Lebanon, years in the Air Force. You're not a, as you say, you're not some kind of religious wacko.
Well, no, I'm not, nor am I the type you're likely to find prowling around Stonehenge in the middle of the night wearing a white cloak.
As much fun as that might be.
Lighted candles singing Moonlight Becomes You. No.
Right, exactly.
I say this only so that the listener will really believe it. I was once chief of the policy branch of the United States Air Force Psychological Warfare Division. I was, you know, I don't go to Gaia meetings on mountaintops. I've always been.
So in a way, you had to be convinced yourself that this was real.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that, I have no question.
In fact, you say at one point after these things kept happening and happening, that you wrote, my interpretation of this event was Peter saying, Dad, you need a building to fall on top of you?
Oh, that is the one with the light. Did I discuss that?
Yeah, you did.
Well, did I go with the three-globe chandelier?
No, you haven't talked about that one.
Oh, well, you must have interrupted me. Now, here's what happened. I was all over that halogen light, and when it turned itself on and off, and then it never worked again. And the next day in particular, I spent a lot of time fiddling with it, you know, and, oh, no, you can hope so hard that something is so that you become, for a while, an intensely skeptical person because you want to leave no stone unturned.
Right.
But that, not that night, but it was two nights after the halogen lamp came on, that at the end of the evening, Julie picked up the cat, take it up to bed. I sat at my computer checking for any late emails, and I saw a light source flashing in the screen. I turned around, And it's the four globe chandelier. I'm staring at it right now. It had been off, but now it was as if an invisible hand was manipulating a dimmer so that the lights would go from total extinction very slowly up to full illumination, then very slowly down to total extinction three times in a row. I don't know how, well, I know how you might interpret it. I don't know how your listeners will. But my interpretation was it was dead. I mean, it was Pete saying, "Dad, you need a building to fall on top of you." It was me.
So you were a skeptic yourself. I mean, you in a way, when you wrote this book, knew how skeptical the reader might be because you had been
that
skeptical yourself.
Right. And that is why, Deal, that I did... I devoted some time at the outset telling the reader, humorously mostly, about myself, because you have to trust the messenger before you hear the message.
That's right.
And that's what that was all about.
Did you hesitate at all putting stories about your friend Shirley MacLaine in there just for that reason?
Oh, Shirley. Yeah, I talked to Shirley just about a week ago, as a matter of fact. No, I did not. Shirley's a believer. You know, she is. And that was a sweet story I told
her. It was a very sweet story, especially
yeah.
The one where she goes with you to visit a sick friend in the hospital.
Oh, maybe that's worth telling you.
It is.
Here is what Shirley MacLaine is like. We are in New York basically to try to convince Daryl F. Zanuck to make my screenplay of John Goldfarb, Please Come Home, which Shirley was the star.
Yeah, it was one marvelous movie.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know Shirley well at that time at all. But I had a grammar school. My best friend was out on Welfare Island somewhere. He had Parkinson's. And I hadn't seen him since grammar school. But I had checked. I knew he was there. And I asked Shirley at breakfast if she would like to come with me because, you know, the greatest gift I could bring to my friend would be a movie star.
Right.
She didn't hesitate for 2 seconds. And she came with me that day. In fact, she kind of monopolized Tommy. His name is Tommy Foley. She sort of interviewed him. She chatted him up for quite a while. I mean, that's a beautiful person.
And you remain friends for a long time.
Oh, we are. I'm going to be seeing Shirley on May 9th. She's coming out here to a theater to do a one-woman show. We'll get together then. Oh, she has a huge heart.
And I'm sure she loves this book. I mean, I just had that gut feeling she must.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, no, she does. She's read it. Yeah, she does.
Now, another one that, I mean, there's story after story here that kind of rocks you. Your son's birthday was May the 17th.
That's right.
And Julie was in Bethesda.
I know.
She was meeting a girlfriend for lunch. Tell that story to our listeners.
I know the one, yes. Julie met a lady friend for lunch at the Woodmont Grill. They were in the middle of the street, crossing the street, and there was no traffic, and Julie was telling her lady friend about Peter. She had seen sort of a derelict, you know, slumped on the ground with his back against the wall. And she was telling her, you know, because of Pete's bipolar, he could easily have ended up like that man there. At that moment, that man raised his arm and yelled out, "My birthday is May 17th. And Julie flipped, and her lady friend said, What's the matter? She said, "That's Peter's birthday, May 17th. What made that man do that?
You went out and met this guy.
An incident like that, Deal, can be an extraordinary, let's face it, but still some kind of a coincidence. But when you have this kind of thing happening over a period of, 8 years, in that context, it's not rational to view it just as a coincidence at all.
Not rational. Didn't you go out and meet this this man?
Yes. His name is, badgered him to give a name, and he said his name is Pee-wee. And he has quite an alert mind. He sleeps outdoors in an alcove of this building. And he is a wizard on the history of baseball.
Brooklyn Dodgers, right?
He can give you the batting average of any player who's ever lived. But he lives there on the street. You know.
And you asked him if May 17th meant anything to him, right?
Yeah, he said it's my birthday. Well, he had already shouted that out to...
But he didn't remember shouting it out.
No, he didn't. He didn't. But I queried him to make sure. I asked him, what is your birthday? He said May 17th. So
these experiences have been happening for 8 years.
8 years. Now, Peter passed away 9 years ago, and in the interest of full disclosure, over this past year, I haven't noticed anything I could call a message from Pete, I must say. But I guess he figures after 8 years.
Right.
I haven't gotten...
Well, also, you're probably doing you've probably been doing, writing a book, the very thing he wanted you to do.
That is... Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's right.
Because I knew you were busy writing all last year, this book.
Now you bring me back to Pete saying at the age of 3, I came here to help people.
Right.
Well, what is this book? It's Pete still helping people. Thank you. That just occurred to me.
And I know it's early in the game yet because the book has been out almost 2 months.
About three weeks, actually.
Okay, I'm glad you told me that because Amazon puts it back a month earlier. Now, for our listeners, I want to remind them that this book by William Peter Blatty is entitled Finding Peter, A True Story of the Hand of Providence and Evidence of Life After Death. I noticed that in addition to a Kindle edition, there's also an audiobook. Is that right, Bill?
I think there is an audiobook, but I've never heard it. Yeah.
Well, I love audiobooks, so that's another option that listeners have.
Yeah.
And you in a way have not just spoken to people who have lost children, loved ones. You're really speaking to everyone who has gone through serious suffering and tragedy in life.
Yeah, of course.
Because you talk about the importance of what you call intense hope.
Yes. There are times, you know, when you're feeling particularly broken, when let me say, my faith seems, you know, less like a true belief than an intense hope. But those are the moments when you really need to know that death is a liar. I mean, death as oblivion simply does not exist. It isn't there. Maybe this is venturing into a boring area, but there is an argument from reason for life after death, which is unassailable. May I mention?
Yes. I mean, you're a Georgetown graduate. You've earned the right.
Yeah, a deal, I'm sure you already know. It is simply this. Never in all of history has there been a universal desire by all of mankind, that's by every single person, for something that doesn't exist. Never. It's irrational. But every human being who lives now and has ever lived has an innate desire for perfect happiness.
Yes.
Well, you can't have something that doesn't exist if you think that death means oblivion. Because that's it. You're finished.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah, no, so I love that one. Oh, well, God.
What have readers been telling you so far? I noticed that the reviews that I could find, and they're quite uniformly positive, even from those who approach the book with a very skeptical mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I check. The only thing I've seen are customer reviews in places like Amazon, and largely the great preponderance is that it's given those who have lost a loved one comfort, and that of course was its purpose. It's some people of course find it very humorous up front, and that also was part of the plan. Keep you.
Well, you pulled off what I call indirection.
Yes.
You got people listening to you by not talking directly about the supernatural or about the afterlife. You got to them
that is,
through your humor.
And again, they had to know that I'm not some, you know, wild-eyed follower of Gaia or New Age or...
Well, hasn't storytelling always been the best way to tell the truth?
That is, oh, sure, of course it is. Course.
Not preaching, right?
No preaching. No, none whatever. It's all real deal. It's all real. I wish I could meet and hug every single person who has lost a loved one, especially a child, and say, it's okay. It's okay. Talk to your dead child. He will hear you. By the way, that reminds me, it's a little bit flippant, but have you ever pondered, as I did a couple of months ago, about the origins of the expression, never speak ill of the dead?
No.
Well, I've decided the reason is because they can...
Because they can hear you. Beautiful. It must be an Irish thing.
What else could be the origin of that saying?
I bet you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, deal. It's all going to be all okay one day for everybody.
But I think in reading the book, I got the sense that it was Peter's own life that led to you and Julie even being open to interpreting and reading his experiences the way you did.
Well...
Because he was such an innately spiritual child.
I'm not sure about that. Julie is an extremely spiritual person. In fact, she's a... spiritual advisor for the Our Lady of Bethesda retreat house around the corner. And I, of course, you know, have been rock solid in my faith for God knows how many years. I wasn't always, even with all my intellectual defenses of the faith that I learned back when Georgetown was Catholic. You had to study logic and epistemology, ontology, cosmology, and all of that, all the intellectual defenses of your faith, your belief in God. Yeah.
But he was a kind of child that
is mystic.
Was always had a kind of spiritual aura. Is that fair to say?
He did. I remember, you've jogged my memory for something. We lived in Hidden Hills, California, and Peter was 5, maybe, and Paulie was 3, or maybe they were a year older than that. And Julie asked Paulie something about seeing or hearing things. And Paulie said, no, but Petey does. He sees.
That could come right out of an English Gothic movie.
I remember another saying of Chairman Peter back at that very, very early age. It had something to do with his belief in and love of Jesus. But he added to that, but I can't get behind a talking snake.
Now, the pain, we have about 5 minutes left. Bill, and I want to ask about the pain.
Oh, please.
Has the pain dulled because of these experiences that you have become so certain are from your passed away son? Has that dulled the pain?
Well, the pain to begin with was excruciating. Whatever you face, at least in my case, the shock of the impact of the passing of someone so young whom you love so much. We bought this house, and there's a swimming pool in the basement, which no one here has ever set foot into. But I remember walking around and around that pool for maybe up to an hour, just crying out Peter's name. That was my initial reaction, and for quite a while, until I found that medal. And then everything, you know.
Did you start to heal some then?
Did I what?
Start to heal at some point?
Yes. Oh, very, 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 very definitely. Well, good old Pete, he made sure that my faith was buttressed by his constant prodding. By the way, this is not unique to me, at least in terms of a book about 50 years ago, there was Anglican bishop named Pike, Bishop Pike.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned him in his book, James Pike.
At age 21, and he wrote a book detailing what he thought were messages from his son. It was called The Other Side.
Yes.
It would be an interesting read for your listeners.
You begin by talking about it as paranormal.
But
you don't really end up on the note of paranormal. Was that just a strategic choice on your side to use that word?
No, well, there are paranormal phenomena that I think P.T. is the...
Well, you are the author of The Exorcist,
and
so I really
actually
should...
Like, yeah, long before Peter was even born, I've had experience of paranormal phenomena that are sometimes quite extraordinary, sometimes extremely funny. Did I have forgotten whether I included the one about Richard Pryor in the book?
You did. That was a very touching story.
Oh, wow.
We've got a few minutes left. Can you tell that story
I knew Richard Pryor. I was interested in him for a part in a movie I had written and was going to direct. And he invited me and my wife to dinner. And there was a good group there, Sidney Poitier. I remember I met him there. And my wife and I are sitting in a sort of a love seat right in front of the fireplace. And above the fireplace, there was a massive oil painting, I don't know, 5x5, 5x6. Richard was approaching us with a tray with sugar and creamer when suddenly this painting crashed to the ground. Now, first thing I feel is, in the dense silence, every eye in the room I felt was on the back of my head as the probable cause for some reason. And we examined, by the way, Peter's only, or rather Richard's only comment was, "Sugar?" We examined that thing, and it had been hanging on the wall above the hearth by an ingot, a thick ingot, maybe 6 inches were protruding and tilted, you know, upward. And attached to the painting was a circular leather thong. We examined that. It was unbroken. How could that painting have... I have no idea. I still don't know.
Well, you one part of your book that I failed to mention was, and we don't have time to go into it now, were all these types of paranormal events that happened around your publishing The Exorcist and making a movie, a successful movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when time's run out, I'm so glad, Bill Blatty, you've had the time to be on the show, and I want to encourage all of our listeners to buy and read your new book, Finding Peter. It's available to Amazon and in bookstores, and I'm sure people are going to be just as touched and benefit from it just as much as I did.
And may I add, for those who do and who have lost a loved one, I swear to you, I exaggerated not a single word of the events in Finding Peter, nor did I make up a single word. It's all absolutely true.
Thank you, Bill Blatty. And to those of you who have been listening, please join me after this short message for another wonderful guest.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. You may be Catholic today merely because your family is Irish or Italian or from the Philippines. Going to Mass is what you do because your family has always done it. But being a member of the body of Christ is so much more than a cultural or ethnic identity. Being a son or daughter of the King of the Universe is so much more than something you do. It is who you are, and it goes to the deepest level of your identity and your reason for existing. God wants to draw us into His family to change our lives forever. But He also wants us to be willing members of that family. And so we have to give Him permission. God has no grandchildren. Own your relationship with God and His church.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
How does the first commandment encompass the virtue of charity? The Catholic Catechism says it commands us to love God above all else and to love all creatures for Him and because of Him. There are numerous ways to sin against God's love. The sin of indifference neglects or refuses to contemplate divine charity. Ingratitude refuses to even acknowledge divine charity or return to God love for love. Lukewarmness is hesitation or negligence in responding to divine love. Spiritual sloth occurs when a person rejects the joy coming from God and is repelled by divine goodness. Finally, actual hatred of God denies His goodness and curses Him as the one who forbids sin and inflicts punishments. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
One of the signs of strong commitment between a husband and a wife is that they have a strong identity as a couple. Having a strong couple identity means there's a me, a you, and an us, like the Trinity. All three identities matter, and all are honored in how we go through life together. Unfortunately, new research by sociologist Dr. Paul Amato argues that couples are fast becoming married singles. Millennial couples are substantially less likely than couples in 1980 to eat together, visit friends together, go out for leisure activities together, or work on projects around the house together. They were less likely to participate in clubs or groups together as well. Home alone becomes alone together. Catholic couples can stand against this tide. Make time for your marriage when you plan your week. Remember that the most important activity is family life. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios, so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store on the right side of the page, just below the EWTN logo. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.